herzlich willkommen beim Ärztetag, dem Podcast der Ärztezeitung. Mein Name ist Elisabeth Kerler und ich bin Volontärin im Online-Ressort. For the first time ever, the NGO Médecins Sans Frontières, short MSF, in German Ärzte ohne Grenzen, in English Doctors Without Borders, takes part in the UN Climate Change Conference. The rural generalist and public health physician Dr. Lachlan McIver advises MSF in concerns of global health and tropic diseases. In this regard, his research is mostly concentrated on islands in Asia and the South Pacific. He is born in Australia and recently has been in Mozambique. Today, he is speaking to me. Welcome, Dr. McIver.
Hi, Elizabeth. Please call me Lachlan. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you today.
Thank you. So let's start. Why is MSF participating in the UN Climate Change Conference?
I guess the short answer, Elizabeth, is it's time. MSF has been working on topics related to climate change and health for many years, even if we were not thinking about them or describing them in those terms at the time. So I think there has been for a long period now an expectation on the part of the public and the international health community that MSF should have a voice and should have a position on issues related to the health impacts of climate change and, in fact, other elements of what we refer to as planetary health. And so I think it is finally time that MSF is present at the Conference of Parties, COP26, and that we have the confidence to, as we say, to bear witness, to speak out about the issues that are affecting the patients and populations in the many countries where we work around the world.
That's quite fascinating. So you have been an eyewitness for MSF in these regards in Mozambique?
Well, Mozambique is one of the first projects for MSF to have a specific focus on planetary health as part of the project design and thematics. And the reason why Mozambique is a little bit special for us at the moment is because we have a new project being developed in the country that from the very beginning is looking to consider what are the health impacts of climate change and what are other health problems in human populations related to the interactions between humans, animals, and the environment. And what can we as MSF do to try and reduce those impacts on the human population? Mozambique is not the only country where we have that kind of interest or concern. In fact, most of the countries where MSF works are among the most vulnerable countries in the world when it comes to the health impacts of climate change. But we are only now starting to really have that focus and have that emphasis as part of the way we plan and implement our projects. So I guess it's really an evolution in our way of working to take a broader view of the determinants of health, to consider climate, environment, and other aspects of planetary health.
So what have you done there?
So in Mozambique, I was helping our very hardworking and devoted team to design a new project in the north of the country, in Nampula province, to have several areas of work, medical topics that are linked to planetary health. Those include malaria, which is among the most sensitive of infectious diseases to changes in the environment and climate. Other types of mosquito-borne diseases, for example, we are going to be checking for the presence of dengue fever, which is one of the mosquito-borne viruses of most concern around the world, including in relation to climate change. We're also going to be looking at and attempting to address some specific diseases related to water, such as cholera, one of the most fatal diarrheal diseases in history, including in the present day. There's also another specific disease that is present in Mozambique and affects a large proportion of the population called schistosomiasis, or sometimes pronounced schistosomiasis. That's a parasite transmitted by a snail that lives in the water that can cause inflammation and really severe damage to the gastrointestinal tract or the genitourinary tract. And then there are the phenomena of natural disasters that are very common in Mozambique, as well as in many other countries in the world, that are linked to, obviously, the weather and changes in climate. So those types of medical issues would be among the priorities for this new project in Mozambique. And while MSF throughout its history has been dealing with infectious diseases and natural disasters, as I said earlier, this is just for us a slightly new way of seeing these problems and thinking about these problems and addressing these problems in our projects that takes a wider view of how our interaction with animals in the environment affects our health as humans and vice versa. So it's a way of working and a way of thinking that we will be looking to replicate, not identically, but in an adapted way to other projects, such as those that we are considering establishing in Madagascar, in Chad, possibly in Latin America and other parts of the world.
So could you please explain in greater detail how climate change influences, for example, the mosquito-transmitted illnesses?
It's a great question. And probably I think it's fair to say that since the earliest days of climate change and health research, which goes back several decades, I think that some people have the mistaken belief that this is a new area of work. In fact, research has been happening in this field since at least the late 1980s. And for obvious reasons, malaria was one of the first topics to really be explored within this field. The reason for that is because malaria is exquisitely linked and exquisitely sensitive to the environmental conditions, because the mosquito populations rely on suitable habitats. So where there is water, where there are certain rainfall patterns, certain levels of temperature, certain humidity is what is required for the mosquitoes to lay their eggs and breed. And then changes in those conditions can expand the number or the range of the mosquito population, and therefore the number of people that are exposed to the bites of the mosquitoes. Changes in temperature in particular also speed up the life cycle of the parasite that is replicating inside the gut of the mosquito. And as the climate changes, as overall we are experiencing a particularly a warmer climate, and as conditions inland from the coast and at higher altitudes become more suitable for the mosquito to live and breathe, that means that more and more people are exposed to the parasite that is transmitted by the mosquito. What that means numerically, to give you an example, the greatest burden of malaria in the world is in sub-Saharan Africa. More than 90% of malaria cases occur in Africa. And of the people that die from malaria, most of them are children. Two-thirds of the deaths that occur every year due to malaria occur in children under five. Now, the best evidence that we have, scientific research, suggests that due to climate change and how it will affect the mosquito population and its habitat, the parasite replication, the exposure of humans to the mosquitoes, that climate change may cause an additional 15 million cases of malaria per year, which would include 30,000 deaths, which means that if you break that down to what that means in terms of a lived experience for the people most affected by malaria, climate change is likely to cause an additional 50 children dying every day from malaria due to the changing climate. And I think those kind of statistics, those kind of realities should be really worrying all of us, particularly when you think about the cruelty, the cruel irony of the fact that these are the people being most affected by the problem that they have had the least contribution in creating.
Yeah, that's quite hard. Would you say that through climate change, also the quality of water gets worse? Because when the malaria mosquito can lay its eggs everywhere, it will also change the water quality, won't it?
Health problems in human populations linked to water quality are more closely related to contamination of the water, so unsafe water, or similarly unsafe sanitation and hygiene as well. So this is where people are able to use the toilet, wash their hands. So water sanitation and hygiene usually link together in public health. And unsafe water sanitation and hygiene are a major, major cause of diarrheal diseases and other types of waterborne diseases. So these currently cause around 1.5 million deaths per year. And again, a significant proportion of those deaths occur in children under five, around one third. And because temperature, rainfall, humidity, and extreme weather events, such as tropical storms, droughts, and floods, all contribute to unsafe water sanitation hygiene. Again, the best evidence that we have suggests that for every 1 degree Celsius increase in air temperature, ambient temperature, that is taking place with climate change, this will increase the cases of diarrheal disease by 5%. Now, 5% might not sound like much, but when you remember that diarrheal diseases related to unsafe water sanitation hygiene already cause about 1.5 million deaths per year, and 5% of 1 million is tens and tens of thousands. So this is still a major problem that we should all be very concerned about and should really emphasize the fact that it is not fair and it is not healthy that so much of the world's population continues to live with unsafe water sanitation and hygiene. This should be a really basic human right that needs to be addressed urgently.
Yeah, I consent with you. In which other ways does climate change influence health besides mosquitoes and water?
Look, climate change affects our health in many ways, both directly through, for example, extreme weather events like storms and floods, also directly through impacts on heat, for example. You know, heat is a significant cause of illness and death, as we see in when heat waves occur in Europe, for example. Air pollution is also both a cause and an effect of climate change. So burning fossil fuels warms the atmosphere and releases particles into the air that are very damaging to our respiratory health. And air pollution is one of the main killers of people worldwide. The World Health Organization estimates that 8 or 9 million deaths per year are due to air pollution, which is very clearly linked to climate change. And then, of course, there's the mental health consequences of climate change. In my years working in the Pacific region, it was really devastating to see how people losing their land, losing their livelihoods, their sources of income, their crops, and needing to relocate because of rising seas is really having a significant impact on the mental health of people in countries like that. But I think we can't be talking about health and climate change today without mentioning malnutrition, food and nutrition insecurity and malnutrition. The World Health Organization estimates are that climate change is already responsible for around 200,000 to 250,000 deaths per year. And that's a deliberate underestimate because it doesn't consider all the categories of health problems related to climate change. But even of that figure, half of those deaths are due to malnutrition. And when you consider that in children, again in sub-Saharan Africa, half of the deaths that occur in children in sub-Saharan Africa every year are due to malnutrition, and climate change is making that worse, yeah, it is inevitable that climate change is going to cause many, many more millions of people, particularly children, to die every year due to starvation because of the way that climate change is affecting crops, fisheries, the soil, the water, and forcing people to go hungry, enter into conflict, be displaced or die.
So what can be done? Is there anything that can help?
There's two main strategies that are fundamental to the fight in terms of climate change and health. One is adaptation, which is what many countries and organizations like MSF are trying to do. That's find ways to manage the negative, detrimental impacts of health on climate change that are already being experienced and that are coming in the future. So, for example, we're working in several countries at the moment to develop a climate-based early warning system for severe epidemics of malaria so that we can be better prepared and better informed and better able to protect our communities from the impact of those epidemics using climate information. We're also undertaking a study looking at the forces, the determinants, the factors that affect food and nutrition insecurity and malnutrition in East Africa so that we can be better able to anticipate where such nutrition crises may occur in the future and how we can be better prepared to deal with them. Those are examples of adaptation. But what is far more important that we do as a global society, far more important, is mitigation. And this is actions to slow, halt, and reverse the effect of climate change itself. It is just unacceptable that we are living in a world where we continue to dig up dead dinosaurs and prehistoric forests and burn them into the atmosphere for energy when there are several other viable alternative forms of energy available to most of the world. It's unacceptable that we are still doing this when it is so clearly causing so many negative impacts on many aspects of our lives, including on health. And I think one of the greatest delusions that we are experiencing as a global society is that climate change is some distant threat that won't affect me, won't affect my family, that's happening to other people in other parts of the world, or will happen to other people in the future. We need to stop burning fossil fuels now, stop emitting carbon, and deal with the effects of climate change that we will still experience because of what we have already done in terms of carbon emissions and the climate change that is already inevitable. But if we do the right thing, act responsibly, and protect our health, our family's health, our children's health, and the health of future generations, that would mean stopping burning fossil fuels now, switching to alternative, sustainable, renewable sources of energy, and eventually we will emerge into a world where the damaging effects of carbon emissions are no longer something that we'll have to deal with, although I'm sure we'll have other health problems to deal with by then.
Yeah, so Lachlan, let's come to one more specific point. Climate change also has an impact on biodiversity. Please explain, is there a connection of the rise of zoonosis and the disappearance of ecosystems?
Yeah, so here we're getting into a slightly broader discussion of what many people were referring to these days as planetary health. So this is the interaction between humans, animals, and the environment that includes climate change as a major factor, but also includes processes like deforestation, environmental degradation, land use, resource depletion, and biodiversity loss. So a lot of these factors are linked. So, for example, you know, climate change causing droughts, leading to desertification, the expansion of desert areas, is linked to deforestation and land use, is linked to reduction of water sources, loss of food supplies, conflict, migration. It can be hard to separate these processes because they are all sort of connected in some way, or most of them are connected. The problem of zoonoses that you refer to can occur in several contexts. For example, in the awful floods in South Sudan at the moment that have something like 700,000 people displaced by the floods, causing hundreds if not thousands of deaths already, and with major problems yet to come, including malnutrition because of loss of crops and food insecurity, including epidemics. Some of the epidemics that we're concerned about are zoonoses, because what do floods do? They force people to move. They also force animals to move. And so when humans and animals are brought into closer contact by disasters such as floods, that's when we see outbreaks of certain infectious diseases such as leptospirosis. But that's a different type of phenomenon to, for example, there's what we call spillover events, where viruses like Ebola, or even, you know, most likely like SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, are triggered by the virus jumping from a non-human vertebrate species to humans. And that is, throughout history, in fact, is due to this increased interaction between humans and animals in a way that is somehow unnatural or out of balance with the environment. So, for example, food insecurity due to climate change, desertification, deforestation forces people to look for different food sources. And there's very strong argument to say that it was the search for meat in the bush because of food insecurity that led to the initial cases of Ebola. So again, it's impossible to separate ourselves from animals in the environment. We all share the same planet, but we need to think a lot more consciously and carefully about how we interact with our environment including the plants and animals and other organisms that share the planet with us, and think about how they affect our health and we affect theirs, because these are fundamentally connected. And again, if we as a human society think that we can avoid having an impact on our environment, or our environment doesn't have an impact on us, then we are kidding ourselves, living in a dreamland.
So I would like to stress this even more, because COVID-19, for example, is something that, well, has an influence on us all, even in Europe, where we are in the happy place of low consequences until now. Have you expected that a pandemic like COVID-19 would come?
Look, many people, including myself, knew that a pandemic was coming. I mean, a pandemic is always coming. It's just a matter of when, not if. A form of coronavirus has been considered by many scientists and experts for some years to be among the most likely causes of the next pandemic. But there are other candidates. They're mostly viruses. They're often respiratory viruses because they're easily transmitted. And for example, the World Health Organization has a specific department working on the examination of emerging infectious diseases, including those with pandemic potential. So, you know, this particular coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, is a novel coronavirus. So it's not that we predicted this one specifically, but it was inevitable that another pandemic would happen. It was more just a question of if and how bad it would be. And you'll have to forgive me for saying, but the same truth still applies to our current and future situation. This will not be the last pandemic that the world experiences. The key question will be, how much will we have learned from this pandemic that we can apply to be better prepared and thus less impacted by the next one?
So do you think the next pandemic is already raring to go?
Raring to go. Look, who knows? I mean, we are still seeing cases of Ebola from time to time in several countries in Africa. So it's not that that pandemic threat has been and gone. It still exists. The same is likely to be true of COVID-19. The virus is unlikely to disappear completely from our society. We still have outbreaks of influenza, as many people know, were the causes of major, major pandemics in the early 20th century. So there will be other pandemics. I certainly don't have the expertise to say when it will happen or what the causative organism will be, but it will definitely happen. And we just have to be smarter, be better coordinated, and be better prepared, including building on the lessons we've learned this time, can only hope to experience overall less devastation and death next time and the time after that.
So what exactly can doctors prepare for that?
Look, it depends which kind of doctors you're talking about. I respect that your audience may be very broad, but mostly medical. Look, there are medical professionals and other researchers who dedicate their careers to the field of emerging infectious diseases. So I'm certainly not one of those specialists. I imagine most of your listeners are not such specialists, but we must respect and support those who are doing that invaluable research. I think for the rest of us, as health professionals, as medical professionals, whether we work directly with patients on the front line as generalists, or whether we work as different types of specialists in secondary or tertiary or quaternary centres and hospitals, whether we work in public health, we have a responsibility not to be complacent, to be alert, to be informed, to make sure that we stay current with the emerging research on infectious disease threats. And I think we have a role as advocates, not just as clinicians who treat our patients, but as advocates for our patients and our communities, to make sure that people's rights and people's health are protected and not forgotten or overlooked in political arguments, for example, or sacrificed for the sake of economies. To me, and I imagine for many of your listeners, health is one of the most fundamental human rights. And that should be one of the things that we prioritize the most in our political discussions and in the way we construct our societies. So we as doctors have a responsibility to speak out on behalf of and to protect the interests of our patients, particularly our most vulnerable patients. those living in poverty, those from minority and Indigenous populations, those with chronic conditions and disabilities. We have an ethical duty to be their champions, and that means that we need to stay informed and be able to inform our patients and educate our communities and educate our political leaders, because they're not doing a great job of things right now, as we can all see.
So I think this was a beautiful sentence to the end. If you want to tell anything else, our listeners, here's your chance.
Okay. Well, look, thank you again for the opportunity to speak to you, Elizabeth, and through you to your audience. I hope that they have found the topic interesting, as broad and complex as it is. And look, I have spent much of my career working as a clinician, fighting the good fight, one patient at a time. And so I want to just acknowledge and respect the vital work that all of you fellow doctors are doing out there. You're my brothers and sisters. I support you. And yeah, look, please keep reading, keep educating yourselves, support Doctors Without Borders and all the other NGOs that are out there doing the vital work to some of the world's most neglected populations. I want to acknowledge and support the great work that you're all doing every day. Thank you.
Oh, thank you too. I'm sure we'll keep that in mind. So once again, thank you very much, Dr. Lachlan McIver. Und danke auch allen, die zuhören.